to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I am Veronica Alashina, and coming up on the program...
Yeah, people are expected to use things like MyGov. They need to be able to be aware of how to roll over their own super. They need to be able to get cash out through an ATM or use other financial processes. Yeah, whether it's internet service or a whole range of other facilities aren't there, or the knowledge isn't there in order to make use of these sort of technologies.
How have the Banking Royal Commission recommendations failed Indigenous communities? Also on the show...
If we continue on the current trajectory, what will the state of Australian residential real estate look like in 3 years' time, 5 years' time, 10 years' time?
How might changing negative gearing policies impact on the housing market? All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, for over 2 years now, the Reserve Bank of Australia has kept the interest rate at a record low of 1.5%. But the RBA has always remained optimistic that the next movement of the interest rate would be upwards. This week, Governor Philip Lowe said the RBA had adopted a more neutral policy stance and stated that further cuts might be appropriate if the economy called for it. Meanwhile, NAB said they are also changing their forecasts to predict an interest rate cut. But are they the only bank to do so? Ben Robinson spoke to Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics to find out.
Most of them were saying that they will be sitting on the fence for quite some time, the Reserve Bank. But over the last quarter, more of the analysts were saying there are more sort of indicating issues that suggest more risks. And now I think the analysts are coming out and saying more likely on the downside. But yeah, I think NAB's the first official big player to say it.
So what were the things that prompted these analysts to change their perspective?
Yeah, so we've seen a slowing of GDP growth over the last little while. And half of GDP is actually to do with consumption from consumers, right? In other words, consumers spending, right? And we've also seen a slowing of consumer spending over the last few months, particularly to do with the fact that costs of living continue to rise, whereas incomes don't. And as a result of that, many households are actually finding it quite hard just to keep the finances together. So they just don't have the same ability to spend as they did. So that's sort of a very important factor in all this. Plus, of course, the impact from the resource sector and exports and the exchange rate benefits that we had are looking as though they could be easing. And so effectively, they're thinking that forward, the GDP number will be a bit lower. I think that's probably the root cause of it.
How would the RBA feel about NAB's statements?
So the Reserve Bank tends to have a relatively optimistic view of things, and they've tended to want to talk the economy up and, basically present all the positive signs. And, you know, they're talking about the employment rate coming down and those sorts of things, and we've had, you know, massive growth over a long period. But I do think that they probably are aware of the fact that the scenarios are looking a little bit less firm than they did. And in fact, they've actually reduced some of their forward projections in terms of future GDP growth themselves. They're also saying that inflation will be somewhat lower. So my own view is I don't think they'll be particularly surprised by the fact that now, some people are talking about the next rate cut will be done. I've been saying it for about a year, by the way, so I've been a bit of ahead of the curve on this one. So my own view is I don't think it fundamentally changes the RBA's perspective, and I wouldn't have thought they'd be that surprised.
Why were you ahead of the curve? What were the things a year ago that you saw?
Yeah, so I was looking at households, right? So I survey households. I look at what they're telling me with regard to their income and expenditure and how they're managing their finances. And I've been watching for the last 18 months to 2 years the tightening of household budgets. So more and more households are saying, gee, it's really tough to be able to actually, you know, make my mortgage repayments and pay my other bills. And it's because income in real terms has not been growing for most households over the last 5 or 6 years. It's not a new thing. It's been quite some time. But that means that on average, you know, real incomes are down, let's say, 5% from where they were 5 years ago relative to the cost of living. And that's really biting. So I've always felt that that's going to be the critical issue, because the Reserve Bank effectively used the household sector to support the economy as the mining boom came off back sort of 5, 6 years ago. But the household sector is unable to support the economy, you know, forever. And the other point is that households have very big debts, so their mortgages are very large. And those debts are bearing down very heavily. So I've been watching those develop over the last couple of years, and that's why I felt that the next move was likely to be down rather than up.
So let's look towards this year and later this year. What are the chances that the RBA will cut the rate before the federal election?
I think it's very unlikely they'll rock the boat before the election. I think that, you know, assuming the election is in May, which it could be, you know, as late as November, but let's say it's May, I think it's very unlikely they'll do anything until later in the year. I think they'll wait for the next set of results to come out, the next quarter's results. They'll wait for the budget because, of course, there is some potential fiscal loosening going on in the budget. In other words, you know, some giveaways or some tax breaks or what have you to accelerate momentum into the election. So I would suspect they will wait till after the election. But in the second half of this year, if the GDP number continues to slide, and if global growth also recedes, as perhaps it could well do, they perhaps will have, you know, a question, let's say September to November, to think about whether they should cut.
One last question as well. What's the lowest they can go?
Well, there's a theoretical point to make. You can go into negative interest. So, you know, for example, Japan and a few other countries around the world get to the point where effectively banks have to pay the central bank for holding deposits, right? So that's called, you know, zero or below. In reality, mortgages will always have a interest rate attached to them. And so the truth is that they've got some room to cut, but, you know, even cutting down towards zero may not have a huge impact on the broader economy, because as you come to approach zero, it's harder and harder to make an impact. So in real terms, they could certainly take it down sort of to 0.5%. But I don't think it would necessarily give the result that they'd want. And it probably signaled more distress in the economy. So in a way, it becomes a self-supporting negative trend rather than it being positive. So very, you know, we're, just to be clear, we are already at emergency low interest rates. 1.5% is hugely low on, you know, any measure that you want to look at around the world and locally. So there isn't really much downside from here, but they could go into negative interest rates, or they could do something else which is called quantitative easing, which is printing more money. So basically creating more cash in the economy to transport it, which is precisely what the US did after the GFC, but that just inflates asset prices. It doesn't really solve the underlying problem. So we're in a rather tricky situation, I think.
Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics speaking there with Ben Robinson.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
How has the final report released by the Royal Commission into Misconduct in the Banking, Superannuation and Financial Services Industry addressed issues in regional Australia and remote communities? Dylan Storer at Wanki Yupur Nana Puru Radio at Fitzroy Crossing, WA, asked Senior Research Fellow for the Australian Alliance for Social Enterprise at the University of South Australia, Jonathan Louth, just how the Royal Commission has failed people in remote communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably we need to take a step back first and consider that in terms of what the Royal Commission was asked to do in the period of time that it has was always going to be a challenge. And looking at those limitations, I don't think it's really a surprise to too many people that the remote communities have missed out. Certainly, if you look at the recommendations that have come out, some of them will speak to some of the concerns in the remote communities, but largely they'll be speaking to either tightening existing regulations and laws or ensuring that they are properly sort of adjudicated over in largely in urban and perhaps a regional setting. So from the outset, the experiences in remote communities haven't really been looked into.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that is purely because of the terms of reference, or is it that it's as small an issue in comparison to the rest of Australia, where majority of Australians live in those sort of big cities, mainly on the eastern coast, that we can sort of keep it out of sight, out of mind?
I don't think it's an either or there. I think it's actually both. So certainly the terms of reference impacted that. Now, you've got a Senate inquiry that's picking up some of the slack there, particularly dealing with things like payday lenders and afterpay and those sorts of things. But again, remote areas will probably miss out there as well. So I think the fact that there was a limited time period, the terms of reference were relatively narrow, and let's not forget that the Commission did go to Darwin to hear some voices from Darwin, but they didn't actually get out into communities or do anything like that or have people from country coming in to talk about their experiences. So they had a limited number of voices to talk about some of the concerns around the financial lives of those on communities. So there was certainly that restriction. But I think there is a more significant point here that's not just about the Royal Commission, but it's about remote community life in general, that it just gets ignored. And there's a range of reasons why that occurs. Now, there's both like sort of structural and institutional reasons, where there's this idea that people don't even, many people on the eastern seaboard or in the major urban centres, have little to no idea what life is like on communities. There's little to no understanding about the history about what occurs on communities. And with that, we're seeing a process of what's called financialisation. So that's where we all of us get sort of tied into financial ways of doing things. In our own lives, we'll see things at a supermarket with things like, you know, the checkout, the self-service checkout, things like that. This incremental financialisation is spreading throughout our lives, and you're seeing it going into remote communities where people are expected to use things like MyGov, things they need to be able to be aware of how to roll over their own super, they need to be able to get cash out through an ATM or use other financial processes and financial products. And as you would be aware, you don't need me to tell you this, that whether it's internet service or a whole range of other facilities aren't there, or the knowledge isn't there in order to make use of these sort of change of these technologies.
So how are the banks and financial institutions and even government to that extent failing to deliver sort of fair and equal access to services into these remote communities?
I mean, there's several examples that come to my mind. And I recently wrote about what I thought was one of the the simplest ones, and that's around accessing money through ATMs. And the fact that generally you'd be paying a $2.50 charge to get money out of an ATM in a remote community. Me, I don't pay anything because I can go to any of the big four majors. I'm here in Adelaide. I can go to any of the big four majors and I can get money out. It doesn't cost me a thing. Now, in many communities, that's not the case. They have to pay $2.50, and there isn't necessarily the financial knowledge or the language skills to appreciate that there is a $2.50 cost to get your money out of your bank. And if that's the case, you might check your account to be paid, and then what happens is you find out your account's in arrears, or you lose a lot of money out of your account. So, and what's quite frustrating about that is that that's not new knowledge. So the ABA, for instance, had a pilot program that finished at the end of 2017, where there was a number of communities where you could get your money out without paying a charge. Now, they got to the end of that trial period, and they said, you know what, we're going to extend this trial period. because we think it's a needed service. Well, the question that I have, well, if you recognise that it's a needed service and you see the importance of continuing that trial, then you already have the solution there. Just universalise it, expand it out.
Yeah, well, it is the same here in Fitzroy Crossing with ATM fees. It would be, well, I recently went overseas and it was, in fact, cheaper for me to get cash out in a foreign currency using a overseas ATM than it would be to simply check my account balance using a local ATM here in town. What would you have you liked to have seen in the recommendations from the Royal Commission to help with these problems? And then, and also more broadly, what would help with these financial issues that are running sort of rife at the moment in remote communities?
Well, you can even see that, let's just take it into the urban setting, you can see that following the report being released, the stock market actually, there was no significant change in the stock market. In fact, some of the banking stocks actually went up. So what is that telling us? That's telling us that the recommendations didn't come as a surprise. So that means it's serving the majority interests of the banks and the financial sector, and I guess the economy more broadly, because there would be concerns, there would have been concerns by the commissioner, who had a very difficult job, I need to stress, that you don't necessarily want to create some level of flight within the economy. Now, if that's happening in an urban setting, that means you can fairly certain that the concerns in regional or remote settings haven't been addressed at all. So certainly some of the things that I would like to have seen, and there is under 1.8, the recommendation 1.8, there's a line that says the ABA should amend the banking code to provide that banks will work with customers who live in remote areas or who are not adept at using English to identify a suitable way for those customers to access and undertake their banking. Now, that is very, very vague. But there is an opportunity there to actually think, well, how can we talk about things like community co-design? How can we spend time in communities talking about, well, what's your financial life like? What would make it easier for you? Because it's not about people sitting in cities deciding what is best for remote communities. That's simply not going to work. And again, you don't need me to tell you that. So there needs to, whether it's ASIC or other government departments, need to head out into remote communities and say, well, what are some of the issues you face here? And how can we take and look at these recommendations and apply them in a remote setting? We could do more here, but that is actually going to take some level of determination and a commitment to funding and a commitment to make sure that we get financial counsellors and financial case managers out into remote communities for days on end. You can't just be fly in, fly out. There needs to be trust built up in those communities, and there needs to be some community-led responses.
Senior Research Fellow for the Australian Alliance for Social Enterprise at the University of South Australia, Jonathan Louth, there with Dylan Storer in Fitzroy Crossing, WA. You're listening to On the Money, Around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Alashina, and now it's business time.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
When the Australian Labor Party heads to a federal election this year, one of the policies it promises to reform is negative gearing. It is proposing to eliminate negative gearing on all new apartments and housing packages, with its aim to give Australian first home buyers a better crack at entering the market. However, some real estate agents are sceptical of the impact this will have on the market. Will more Australians get to own their own home under Labor, or will this just increase foreign investment in the Australian dream? Daniel Ellison has the story.
At some stage this year, Australians will head to the polls for a federal election. And if current polling is correct, the Australian Labor Party will be in government for the first time since 2013. One of the pledges the ALP has made is to eliminate negative gearing as a tax strategy for Australian investors, a move designed to allow more young Australians the opportunity to enter the market and purchase their first home. However, many are questioning both the theory and implementation of this policy. Douglas Driscoll is the CEO of Star Partners Real Estate, and he believes that Labor's policy is misguided, and rather than removing barriers for young Australians to purchase property, will in fact encourage more overseas investors to take advantage of our softening property markets.
We've seen first home buyer numbers almost quadruple in some areas of Australia, And I think by abolishing those concessions, we're going to see ultimately even fewer investors. You know, that's going to have an impact on supply and demand, which are subsequently going to have a roll-on impact on prices, which means that overseas buyers in particular, they're going to see Australian property as good value and, dare I might say, a bit of a bargain.
Negative gearing occurs when the expense of owning a rental property exceeds any income derived from it. So if an investor makes a loss on a property, this loss is applied to the investor's overall income, which then has a knock-on effect, reducing the investor's overall tax. And according to Mr. Driscoll, this isn't just a strategy used by those with the highest incomes.
I think the erroneous view around negative gearing is it's a benefit for the wealthy. It isn't. When you dissect who actually negative gears, you'll realise that. And in fact, two-thirds of all those that negative gear, their taxable income is actually less than $80,000. So any changes to legislation or the abolishment of these concessions is going to have wide felt ramifications.
Mr. Driscoll also believes that the Labor Party has well and truly missed the boat in terms of this policy, and that 3 years ago the market conditions meant that a strategy to eliminate negative gearing would have been much more appropriate.
Well, what I find somewhat perplexing about the proposals from Labor is that I think it's recycled policy. You know, they were talking about the same things 3 years ago, and at that moment in time, with the market being very different then, I actually felt that it had some validity to it. Whereas now, obviously, what with APRA's macroprudential measures, we've seen far fewer investors and far more first home buyers.
According to a recent statement by Chinese international property portal Zhuai.com, the recent softening of the Australian property market will seem like a bargain, especially to Chinese investors, but not all real estate agents believe it's quite so simple. Malcolm Gunning of Gunning Real Estate works with many mainland Chinese investors in Australia and believes that they will face similar problems to local investors.
We have a business in Hurstville, so we're dealing with mainland Chinese constantly, and they're concerned about the current regulation about investment in Australia. So the local buyers are also pulled back, and they're influenced by the same conditions that we're facing here.
Mr. Gunning, who was until recently the president of Real Estate Institute of Australia, argues that Chinese investors especially are finding it incredibly difficult to take advantage of overseas investment due to crackdowns by the Chinese government.
If China allowed their citizens to invest, take money out of China, and at this stage they're only allowed $50,000 per family, and that doesn't buy much in Australia or Canada or America, then they would look, they'd pay the taxes and come to Australia. So that's the first point. The second point is they're also conscious about the drop in prices that we have at the moment. And also, to a certain extent, the xenophobia that raged about 18 months ago. The Chinese are blamed for driving up prices for apartments and that type of thing, particularly new apartments. So they're the major influences, so that has to really be absorbed, and that needs to settle down before I think the foreign investors come back with any sort of numbers.
Mr. Gunning does believe that the intended impact of this policy shift will assist Australian home buyers, at least in the short term.
The investors are going to, the small, mid-range investors, small investors are going to stand back and weigh that up. They're still going to get good capital growth. They're still going to, if it's positively geared, they're making money and paying taxes. But still, you're going to have to balance those sorts of things up. So it will affect the property prices. So people won't overpay. So they'll still sit down and look at what's reasonable value. So they'll be a lot harder on their purchases of second-hand property. Just remember, this doesn't relate to new property. So what it could do, it may well do, is focus the investors more on new property and drive up those prices. So that's where there's an unfair balance, I would have thought.
Mr. Driscoll believes that if negative gearing is eliminated, there may be opportunities for savvy Australian investors to begin purchasing overseas property, and believes that our nearest and dearest neighbour might be the first port of call.
They can actually invest into New Zealand with very little red tape. And I actually think that Australians, the savvy investors, will start to learn from overseas investors and realise that there are perhaps some good deals to be had overseas. Obviously, a lot of the markets internationally, it's very difficult to do that. New Zealand is one of the very few where they can. It's close. Obviously, culturally, economically, there are obvious parallels. So I think it's probably going to be in the not-too-distant future where we start seeing Australian investors start to have a good, long, hard look at New Zealand and weigh it up and see whether it's economically feasible or viable for them to invest the money there.
Malcolm Gunning, however, has a lot more faith in the Australian market and believes that investors should be looking much closer to home if they want to get a bargain.
Don't look to New Zealand, look to Brisbane, look to Perth, look to Adelaide. They're the markets which have got strong growth. Everything about those markets down there hinges on employment. Brisbane has got outstanding opportunities, and that city's starting to get its mojo back again. And Adelaide's just got the one of the big shipbuilding contracts, and they're looking at really putting in our space program down there. So again, they will employ people. So they're the cities that you're going to look at far as growth is concerned. There's no need to go outside of Australia. We've got probably three or four cities bigger than Auckland.
That was Malcolm Gunning of Gunning Real Estate, ending that report from Daniel Ellison. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Elishina. That's all we have time for On the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks to producers Ben Robinson, Dylan Storer, Daniel Ellison, and executive producer Roderick Chambers. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. To find us, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, new episodes coming out every week. I'm Veronica Elishina. We will be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.